It is 12:10 on WGN. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, hanging out for John Williams today. Glad you could join us. Hope you've got a good sandwich or something to munch along with. I just had a plum. The fruit's been great this summer, man. It's just been so good, especially the peaches. I'm not quite sure why that is. Anyway, I digress. The news of the day is that the markets are all pretty down, but so is unemployment. And that was a big surprise. We've asked Greg McBride, Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com, to join us. Greg, it is so nice to have you on the show.
Good afternoon, Elise. Great to talk with you again. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Happy long weekend, right?
Yeah.
I know. That's everybody's response to Labor Day weekend this year. It's like, thank God we made it. Anyway, so listen, I was a little surprised this morning when I saw how much the unemployment number dropped. I feel like it just makes it seem like we're a little bit further ahead. And I've talked to a couple of other of our friends. Lawrence Yoon was on earlier today, and we had Carl Tannenbaum from Northern Trust, giving the sort of official economic perspective. But from Bankrate.com, where you look at interest rates all day long, I mean, it's just been, let's just start in. What's your take on all of this?
Well, you weren't the only one that was surprised by the numbers today in a positive way. Yes, the unemployment rate dropped from 10.2% down to 8.4%. I don't know anybody that wasn't surprised by that, but we'll take it. Saw unemployment down about 2.8 million. We saw an increase in the number of those that were employed, as well as an expansion of the labor force by almost a million people. That means people are coming off the sidelines and back into the labor market. I think that's really a key ingredient that can hopefully be built upon in the months to come. There's still a lot of uncertainty about, the lack of additional stimulus and the expiration of those extended unemployment benefits and what impact that's going to have on consumer spending. But for now, very positive signs on all fronts with regard to the labor market.
I just have to point out that, we added 1.37 million jobs, and the economists surveyed by the Dow Jones had been expecting growth of 1.32 million, so just under that, and they only saw the jobless rate declining to 9.8% as opposed to dropping all the way down to 8.4%. I hate to say this because I don't want to be, like negative Nelly out there, but is it possible that these numbers, it's not that they're not right, but that there's been some sort of a calculation error? Because it feels like for the amount of jobs that we added, it dropped an awful lot.
And that's one of the problems, is that when we talk about the jobs report, we're actually talking about two different surveys that are kind of compiled as one, in the sense that you've got a survey of households and then you've got a survey of businesses. And that job growth number comes from surveying businesses. Now, that doesn't account for the self-employed or gig workers. When you survey households, all of a sudden those numbers start to show up. And so I think that's one of the real positives, is yes, we did see a good growth in jobs, let's just say recovery of jobs, but then at the household level, the number was even more impressive. And I think that's the real positive takeaway, is because when you look at the bigger picture in terms of the self-employed and gig workers, we're seeing them come off the sidelines. We're seeing businesses open back up, people being rehired, people getting back to work, all of which very positive, not only for, at the household level, but, for the broad economy as well.
All right, Greg, we're going to talk in a moment about what is going on with renters, because I think that there is a crisis brewing for renters that the people who are home buyers and sellers just aren't seeing. So stay tuned with us for that. So we're talking to Greg McBride. He's Senior VP and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com, and somebody I have known for many a year, about the housing industry and the effects of, I guess we'll talk about the pandemic on it as well. As of a couple of years ago, according to HUD, there were something like 48.5 million rental units out there, and about 23 million of them were occupied. So we call that around 23 million families who are renting. And yet, renters have struggled mightily in the pandemic. We've seen nationwide bans on the eviction of renters. We've got Congress, who's kind of stalling on rental aid, where we've seen mortgage aid. So, Greg, when you look at what's going on in the housing industry, do you feel like, for landlords who don't get paid, that could be a problem? And maybe it is. I don't know. You probably know better than me. And then renters themselves, what's going to happen there?
Yes. And, for all the talk about the refinancing bonanza and the fact that there's a lot of pent-up demand and housing and, the home sales are up sharply and that the housing sector is really a positive for economic growth, that really sort of drowns out that plight of both renters and landlords that you highlighted. And yes, there's, been this, we've had this extended moratorium, which helps renters for now. It takes off at least one stress in a time of otherwise significant stress. But, is it just sort of kicking the can down the road? Is it, setting people up for, potential eviction down the road whenever those moratoriums are no longer in place? And landlords, I think in particular, there are a number of retirees that rely on their rental real estate for income. And without that rental income coming in, it leaves them in a real cash flow pinch. Particularly if they don't have any type of mortgage forbearance on the property, they're still on the hook for property taxes, property insurance, maintenance, and repairs, which, can really be pinched if there's no cash flow coming in. So, a program that would, sort of make rental payments for people makes everybody whole. It keeps the renters in place without this potential eviction cliff later, and it all from a landlord's perspective, it also is income replacement for them. Both sides of that really suffering as a result.
Yeah, I think it's all well and good if you are a big commercial landlord and you automatically got money from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or they were paying your mortgage for you for about 4 months if your loans were done through them. But for renters and mom and pop landlords, it feels like this is a particularly tough time and they're really at risk of losing their homes. And I feel for them as somebody who's owned rental property in the past, and I have one rental property now in downtown Chicago. I know that the city of Chicago had set aside something like $300 million out of the CARES Act funds, I think it was CARES Act, that they got from the federal government to provide this assistance, life-giving assistance to renters. And I'm wondering, I feel like other cities are doing that around the country as well. But this isn't, to me, this is like a drop in the bucket for what really needs to happen. What are you seeing out there happening for renters that perhaps, or what should happen that you think might be a good idea?
Well, you've hit on it. It's kind of a hodgepodge, right? That, it varies from location to location in terms of what state or local programs might be providing assistance. And, I think that sort of inconsistency is also going to sow further problems. The landlords, in the position where, as you noted, if they're not the mom and pop landlords, they didn't get the Paycheck Protection Program loans that could be forgiven. They're not a big company that can tap capital markets at record low interest rates and get access to funds. No, they, in many cases, they're retirees that need this income to survive, or they're someone who's got limited cash reserves and yet they're having to draw upon that. So, it definitely, puts them in an extremely difficult spot. You feel for both the renters as well as those mom and pop landlords in particular, and both seem to, pleas for help seem to be largely drowned out.
Let's talk about interest rates for a few minutes, because mortgage interest rates have hit all-time lows, I want to say something like 8 times in 2020. Is that right? 8 times or 9 times even? And
yeah, and it's been consecutive weeks as well. So, yeah, it's gone from good to great to better to still better.
I have lost track on how much. I just keep saying they're at or near historic lows, which I think is good enough. But I don't think people really have an appreciation just for how low mortgage interest rates were. So I went on to Bankrate the other day, and I was looking at how much you could get for like a 30-year fixed rate loan or a 15-year fixed rate loan or even a 10-year. And I was amazed to see that 15 years are under 2.5% to a great degree. Is that still the case? Because that was a few days ago, and I know that markets are changing sort of quickly now. But what are you guys seeing going on in terms of interest rate trends?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a historic time in the sense that we've never seen a rate drop to such new to lows that were so far removed from the previous lows. The 30-year fixed rates right now, some of the best rates right around 2.5%, and you know, even with refinancing, you know, 2.5, 2.625. Well, you know, for somebody who locked in at 3.5 or 4% a couple of years ago and thought at the time that was near record lows. Who could have ever imagined rates would be low enough that they'd be in the market to refinance again? Voila, welcome to 2020 where everything is possible, it seems. So, yes, there's this great opportunity to refinance, generate meaningful savings. And, you know, for a lot of homeowners, that savings might be the pay raise they didn't get this year. Shaving $100, $150, $200 or more per month off of that mortgage payment really creates some valuable breathing room at a time when a lot of people need it.
Yeah, I know. It feels like $100 or $200 a month, and that's after tax, right? So it's really more like earning $300 a month. You know, it can really make a big difference just in terms of whether or not you're going hungry. I mean, even something that basic is, I think, on the minds of so many people right now, and it's just heartbreaking. We just have a minute or so left, Greg, but just any thoughts on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac instituting this 0.5% fee for people who are going to refinance starting in December? It was supposed to kick in like out of the blue in September, and then there was huge pushback, and now they've pushed that, you know, to start it back in December. To me, this is just a money grab, right? They need to build up their capital accounts so that when they, you know, come out of conservatorship, which is like bankruptcy for, you know, these guys, that they're going to have all this cash and be able to go out. But are people now going to just push forward their refinancings to take advantage of the low rates, but also not to have to pay this fee?
Well, I think there's a real sense of urgency to do it for exactly that reason. And the fact is, it won't kick in until for loans that are delivered after December 1st, a lot of lenders are going to reflect this in pricing by mid-October, if not sooner, given the timetable to get loans to closing and get those loans delivered. So get on it sooner rather than later, not only taking advantage of those record low rates, but avoiding that fee. And, yes, I have used the exact same term, Elise, money grab. You know, the irony that the Fed is buying $40 billion a month in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage-backed bonds in an effort to drive mortgage rates down. And then what do? They step into the market, institute this half percentage point fee that with no notice and a bogus rationale. They've since pushed it back, but still it doesn't change the fact that this is going to erode some of the savings of refinancing for people that don't get in under the wire.
I hate to say it. I think it's kind of shameful that they were allowed to do this. And for exactly that reason, there is no reason that people who are refinancing pose any bigger risk, which was the whole thing. Oh, it's a risk thing, and we're pricing in risk. And yet people who already have equity in their homes are far less of a risk of going into foreclosure than anybody else. And speaking of foreclosure, we only have about 3.5 million people who are still in that forbearance program. We're down in the 7% range from closing in on 10%. So what's the big whoop anyway?
Yeah, that whole risk, that just did never pass the smell test for the reason that you just pointed out. And they've since kind of backpedaled off of that and said, well, it's because all these forbearance programs, it's not free. It comes at a cost. That makes a little more sense. I don't know why they just didn't say that from the outset, but, you know, again, it's, you know, this is really reaching into the pockets of homeowners that are generating savings and kind of siphoning some of that off.
Yeah, like anybody believes that they aren't pricing in some of the risk or the costs of that forbearance program when people actually come out of it. I'm sure if we all look closely at what they're repricing and how they're rebuilding those programs, there's a little bit extra built in. But, you know, I've become a little bit cynical. What can I say? Greg McBride,
I'm with you.
Right? Greg McBride is Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate. Greg, so great to have you on the show again. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Elise. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for John Williams today. It has been quite a day on Wall Street. As you just heard, all of the indices have been down today. They are up, not down quite as much as the bottom number, although that seems to be trending down again. There was a lot of concern over, after we had the best August in 30 years, that we were really in for it coming back in September and October, which traditionally are tough months for stock markets. I don't know why. I mean, maybe you're old enough to remember the October crash. That was a long time ago, right at the beginning of my career in covering the financial markets, and worrisome for everybody as we saw the markets drop, you know, something like 20% a single day. It was down a huge number. Today, right now, NASDAQ is sort of taking the biggest tumble. It's down a little over 3%. And we've seen this is a couple of days now in a row that we've seen NASDAQ drop, but it's still at over 11,000. And I think what's important to remember here is that, you know, day trading, which has become quite a big thing with platforms like Robinhood, you know, day trading has become this thing that people seem to do. And during the coronavirus pandemic, when you're home more, it, you know, could feel like you have a choice of playing video games or you could do something more constructive by day trading. And I'm here to tell you, day trading doesn't always work out well for people. When the markets go up and up and up like they have been doing, there can be a false sense of security around the idea that you're actually day trading to success and you're going to make money. And we read articles in the paper about how people have been, you know, making piles and piles of money by day trading. It's very, very difficult to do. It's not something that I personally would ever try, but what I will tell you is that when you invest for the long run and you do remix your allocation from time to time, and which is a perfectly good thing to do, and it's definitely something that I've done. In fact, I just did it recently. And it's funny, my husband and I have been married for so long that we both separately, without having any discussion, reallocated our portfolios in the exact same, like within a day of each other.
Now that sounds like a geeky couple.
I know. We are so geeky. That's a great word for it. But I said to him the other day, I said, maybe this was like a week or two ago, I said, oh, Sam, I've just rebalanced. I thought I should tell you. And he goes, really? I just rebalanced. What day? And it turned out it was like within 24 hours of each other. So anyway, just to note that these kinds of days should and weeks should not make you nervous, particularly with the kind of year that we've had. It's been a very up and down year. But we are in a good place. And if you are in it for the long run and you don't have to liquidate your portfolio anytime soon, you know, days like this should just, you know, remind yourself that the stock market is going to continue to do fine over a long period. And as long as you're in the market, it's better than sitting on the sidelines and just waiting to jump in at some unknown point in time. All right, it's 37 minutes past the hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and Rich Sharga joins me on the line now. He is Executive Vice President of Realty Track, and a mortgage and real estate expert. Realty Track looks at data on 150 million pieces of property in the U.S. Rick, did I get that right?
Yeah, my eyes are really tired from looking at all those property pieces of data.
all those single data points, I keep wondering if it's like a Chuck Close painting where you're like, you're up close and you see all the million points of data and then you step back and it's like a big image of something. But anyway, so tell us, Rick, as you're looking at delinquent properties and other kinds of properties out there, you know, sort of at the high level, how do you feel that the real estate market is doing right now?
Well, I would have two takeaways from a high level for your listeners. One is when you look at the delinquency numbers, the initial reaction is to gasp and get a little bit scared. I would have the same advice for people that you just had regarding the stock market. The numbers aren't something you should necessarily be worried about right now. They're kind of what we would have expected given all of the different machinations put in place by the federal, state, and local governments to help people avoid losing their homes, to avoid defaulting on their loans. And so, you know, about 4 million people took advantage of government programs to go into mortgage forbearance. And when you look at that, it looks overwhelming. But the reality is that a quarter of those people have never stopped making their mortgage payments, and less than 10% of the people who exit forbearance are actually going into delinquency. So the program's working exactly as it was supposed to work in terms of helping people in financial distress make sure they can hang on to their house throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. The other point is that if you just look at home sales, whether it's existing home sales or new home sales, the market has been extremely strong and surprisingly resilient as we've gone through the pandemic. Of all the different sectors of the economy, there's probably not a single sector performing better than housing right now.
Yeah, housing has just been on a tear. And actually, in the new unemployment numbers, we saw today that the number of people in construction, I mean, big numbers got hired, which was good to see because you can't literally build a new home unless you have people to build that home. So I was happy to see that. You know, when it comes to the forbearance, this was sort of interesting to me, this number that of people who went into a forbearance program but made their mortgage payment anyway. What do you think that is?
Well, there was a study done by LendingTree in the early days of the forbearance program, and their conclusion that was between 70 and 80% of the people in forbearance didn't really need to be in forbearance. They'd opted into the program sort of just to hedge their bets in case their financial situation deteriorated. I am surprised that more than 25% of the people who don't have to make a mortgage payment right now have decided to keep making those payments anyway. But as you see people work their way through the forbearance period and come out at the other side, you know, more than 90% of them are doing just fine as they come out. So I think people did take advantage of the government program as a safety precaution. I am cautiously optimistic that we'll see the overwhelming majority of people who have opted into the program exit it successfully. And the fact of the matter is we have a long time to go in this program. The government program was an initial wave of 180 days in forbearance, which means you didn't have to make a mortgage payment for 6 months. And there's an optional 180 days at the back end of that period. So theoretically, people could avoid making a mortgage payment if they needed to for up to a year. And we could be talking about this and the people exiting from the program in March of 2021. So long way to go before this program winds up.
All right. Well, I definitely want to ask you a little bit about homes in foreclosure and what could possibly happen. So stay with us. We need to turn to Steve Bertrand with the Wintrust Business Minute right now.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Billionaire Citadel CEO Ken Griffin has donated $20 million into the fight against the graduated income tax plan in Illinois. It's on the ballot in November. That matches the biggest donation he's made in about 20 years. Maybe a construction job. Researchers at the Construction Coverage Group analyzed new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics to determine which states are the best paying for construction workers, and Illinois comes in number one, a median wage just over $71,000. And Spirit Airlines has a new automated bag drop-off system at O'Hare. The airline says it will eventually let travelers deposit checked bags without interacting with an employee. It uses a facial scan system to get it done. Still needs approval from the TSA. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
And, Orion, what's going on with agribusiness?
As we take a look at prices, not as much movement in grain prices as we find on Wall Street. At the moment, the September wheat contract at the Board of Trade is down 4 cents a bushel. The September corn contract is up 1¾ cents a bushel. And September soybeans up 1¾ cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the October lean hog contract is up 17 cents a hundredweight. The October live cattle contract is up 52 cents. And the September feeder cattle contract is up 30 cents. And again, I remind you, it's a three-day holiday trading weekend. The markets, when they close today, will not open again until Tuesday morning, the day after Labor Day. In the grain trade today, the increasing demand from China has lifted soybean futures to their highest prices in more than 2 years, while corn futures rose on concerns about crop damage from the derecho that swept across the Midwest about 2 weeks ago. The USDA said private exporters sold 318,000 tons of U.S. soybeans to China, and 175,000 tons of soybean meal to the Philippines, all for delivery in the current marketing year that started on September 1st. But it was the second consecutive day the USDA reported that China had booked U.S. cargoes. That country is trying to combat food security issues, and they've also been a big buyer of U.S. corn and pork recently, because the situation with China on the pig population, and keep in mind China is the biggest producer and the biggest consumer of pork, and they lost about half of their hog herd in the past year from the African swine fever. And I listened with interest, Elise, to your discussion about day trading, because having covered the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, I've seen a lot of day trading. Interestingly enough, though, the results I hear are mostly those who were successful, and I hear very little talk about the many who were not successful in day trading, because that is an interesting way to play the financial market. The Farm Progress Show, which is scheduled to get underway next week, and it will, but it will be virtual. Tomorrow morning on the Saturday morning show, Max Armstrong will talk about how you will be able to view the virtual Farm Progress and the Husker Harvest Days events, both taking place next week. So we'll have all of that information for you tomorrow, as Max Armstrong will join us from Boone, Iowa, where the Farm Progress Show will be held virtually. Should be an interesting visit tomorrow morning on the Saturday morning show. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
On WGN, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for John Williams today. With me on the line, Rich Sharga, Executive Vice President of Realty Track, keeping tabs on real estate trends and the market. You know, Rick, looking at RealtyTrack.com, I was really interested at the spread, this little spreadsheet that you did of the where the foreclosures actually are by price range. And so it looks to me like the homes that are most, that you have the most foreclosures are the ones that are under $300,000 in value. Is that what you're saying? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, and that's not atypical, at least, as you probably know. The people that tend to buy the lower priced homes, the entry level homes, very often have the least financial cushion So if you do have an economic downturn or if there is an unemployment spike, very often those are the first people to run into financial difficulties. And similarly, you have typically you have higher incidence of delinquencies and foreclosures among borrowers who use FHA loans because they're, again, very often stretching themselves financially to get their first chance at home ownership. So, unfortunately, some of those people tend to be some of the first ones to fall into financial trouble in a downturn.
Yeah, we see that actually in the current numbers of loans in forbearance, I think, the ones that are sort of FHA, USDA, VA are at a far higher rate in forbearance than sort of your conventional mortgages, right?
Yeah, and not to be too Pollyannish, but even there you're talking about probably 10% of the overall pool of borrowers out there. So, again, across the board, whether it's jumbo loans that are on banks' portfolios or it's conventional loans that are insured or purchased by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or even the more, you call them riskier loans if you'd like, by entry-level buyers in the FHA and VA and USDA pools, the overall market's performing really well. The numbers are a little difficult to read accurately because of all of the foreclosure and eviction moratoria that have been put in place across the country.
Right.
And candidly, that's frozen some foreclosures in a sort of limbo state that had started before the pandemic and normally would have wrapped up by now, but are just lagging on because of the government programs.
That's a good question, though. What do you think is going to happen when we come off of these moratoriums? You know, in terms of foreclosures, we've got renters who aren't paying their rent. I mean, the majority are paying them, but they've been paying it because they've had an extra $600 in their pocket. Do we think that we might see an increase in the number of foreclosures? I mean, what is your data telling you?
Well, I would be hopelessly optimistic if I were to say 55 million people had filed for unemployment and we would see no increase in defaults. That would be the first time in history that ever happened. So, I do expect we're going to see an increase in delinquencies and defaults as we get through the pandemic. A lot depends on how successful we are ultimately at combating this virus and how long the economic ups and downs continue and how many businesses survive that cycle. You raise a really interesting point. Almost all the activity that's been put into action so far in terms of preventing defaults and foreclosures has been aimed at homeowners. Landlords really have sort of been left out on an island. And when you have governments, state governments in particular, that are putting in place prevention of evictions for non-payment, that puts landlords in a bind because now they have tenants who know they don't have to make monthly rent payments and maybe can't make monthly rent payments. But the landlords still have to pay their mortgages and they still have to pay their bills. And so that becomes a real challenge. A lot of people misunderstand the rental market and think that landlords tend to be these either institutional investors or big conglomerates. And the reality is that the overwhelming majority of landlords tend to be mom-and-pop investors who own five or fewer properties. And a lot of them just won't have the financial wherewithal to get through an extended recessionary cycle where their tenants aren't making payments. If we do see another government stimulus program, that would go a long way toward helping remedy the situation. And you and I have talked about this separately, but the reality is that one of the reasons homeownership hasn't taken a hit yet in this recession is that the job losses have been skewed very, very heavily toward renters. So that is an area that we could see some fallout in, unless we see a little bit more, probably government stimulus to help those tenants.
I don't think it's a point that I think we can't underline strongly enough, which is that there has not been enough help given to people who are at the sort of bottom half of the workforce and the ones who are typically renting, the ones who are struggling, the ones who we had somebody call earlier. She's a massage therapist and she was making more money, you know, and now has gone back to doing her job where she's making less money. and she's making less than she was making before. And so she's the kind of person who I think is at risk here of not actually making enough money to manage all of her bills, possibly falling behind. You know, and when you're renting, it's a very short eviction process as opposed to foreclosure where you can stretch that out, you know, by months typically. So it's a concern all the way around, I think. And I would bet that we will, since they're predicting now that we're going to see over 400,000 coronavirus deaths by the end of the year, that we're going to see more foreclosures and more renters get evicted and more landlords have problems down the line. But, you know, I'm hoping I'm wrong.
Wow. So I guess the counter to that is that today's or this week's unemployment numbers were as encouraging as they were. We're now down to about an 8.4% unemployment rate, which is lower than most economists have predicted we'd get to by the end of this year. Now, that the massage therapist example you brought up is a little bit of a warning in those numbers, because even though she's technically employed again, she may not be making as much money as she was before she had to shut down her business. So there's a lot of moving parts here, Elise, and I don't think we're going to see a wave of evictions this year, because everybody, every government agency you can think of, including the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is getting in on the act and trying to prevent evictions. You know, who knew that if you made $99,000, getting evicted was a health concern, but if you made $100,000, it was okay. It's just that the creativity by our government officials is mind-boggling.
It has been quite a year of government intervention in every single part of our lives, for sure. Rich, and you and I can definitely agree on that. Rick Sharga is Executive Vice President of Realty Track and a mortgage and real estate expert and somebody I've come to rely on for some terrific advice. Go to realtytrack.com, TRAC.com for more details. Rick, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Elise. Talk to you soon.
All right. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. The news is next.